everybody in comics is trying to mitigate failure. Nobody's planning for success. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who've signed these deals because they're like, well, it's never going to come to anything. I don't know anyone in Hollywood. I don't have any connections in that world. I'm not going to be able to leverage any of these books to be adapted. It's like, that's not the fucking point. Do you think fucking Siegel and Shuster knew anybody in Hollywood? No. They made an 8-page comic. They made an 8-page comic and it changed the world. And nobody wants to believe in themselves to that level. And I'm not even saying that from like an egotist standpoint where I'm like, I think the Tulip is going to fucking change the globe. Like, I maybe it will. That'd be great. But I'm not planning for that. But you know what I am planning for is that if it does, Nicole and I are the only two people that get to decide what happens with it because we own that book 100%.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the Short Box Podcast, Season 6.
Short Box Podcast was recorded before a live internet audience.
Yo, Short Box Nation, welcome back. This is episode 327, new friends and first-time listeners. Welcome to the show. You're now tuned to the Short Box Podcast. Thanks for joining us. My name is Bodder Milligan, and today I'm bringing you a great conversation with two new friends making their Short Box debut, writer Dave Baker and artist Nicole Gu. They are the creative duo behind the upcoming graphic novel, Everyone is Tulip, an original story that explores the discomfort of modern-day social media fame. It's being published by Dark Horse Comics and will be available everywhere you get your books and comics on June 29th. And before we welcome Dave and Nicole, I want to thank our sponsor, Gotham City Limit, for bringing you this episode commercial-free. Gotham City Limit is Jacksonville's premier shop for comics, toys, collectibles, and a whole lot more. If you live in the area, or if you ever find yourself passing through Jax, stop by the shop on Southside Boulevard and tell them the Short Box sent you. Let's give it up one more time for our sponsor and welcome our guest of honor today. Short Box Nation, it's my privilege to welcome Dave Baker and Nicole Gu to the show. Hey, Dave. Hey, Nicole. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
But who's the sponsor? What's the sponsor?
Our sponsor. We are proudly sponsored. Well, we got two sponsors. We just onboarded a new sponsor within the last 2 weeks. So our sponsor is a comic shop here local to Jacksonville called Gotham City Limit.
Cool.
Amazing comic shop. Shout out to Ben. And then we just onboarded a new sponsor that sponsors a segment in the second half of the show. And they're a Black Hive Tattoo. Fantastic tattoo shop that does all types of artwork and things like that.
This is the real shit. You got a retailer, you got tattoo shops, like none of this CGC, none of this fucking like, you know, these IP farm comic book companies that are just trying to buy their way into this bullshit. Yeah, no hot flips, bro. Oh, man. Fuck those.
We love our home city, and we always try to put a spotlight on and, you know, on the real-life superheroes making it a better place. So I feel like it'd be disingenuous if I didn't, you know, try to give some shine to, like, shops and business owners that I genuinely really like and whatnot. So yeah. It's a blessing to have.
Are there any real-life superheroes from Jacksonville?
After we get done with the official interview, I'll pull up a list of the Jacks.
Because I feel like... Yeah, I feel like there's a couple from there. Like the two that I'm like really obsessed with. Mm-hmm. This is so bullshit. Nobody cares about this, but I want to talk to you about it now. So we're going to talk about it very briefly.
Our Jax listeners right now are like, wait a minute, Jax Love? We're not the butt of a joke right now.
the two that I'm obsessed with are the Phantom Patriot from Texas. Vegas. He lived outside of Vegas. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I can't recall. Let me see if I can pull it up.
Okay, so this dude, it's a crazy fucking story. There's this guy named Richard McCaslin, okay, who was obsessed with comics. He was a former Marine and a former movie stuntman. He went to movie stuntman school, and then he got a job playing Batman at the Universal Studios Batman Forever show. Holy which tells you how long ago this was.
Yeah.
And so he was the zip line Batman. There were like three Batman in the show, right? It's like zip line Batman, car drivey Batman, and pseudo Val Kilmer-y actor-y Batman. And so he was this kind of like really lonely guy who got radicalized by Alex Jones because he lived in Texas for a while before moving to Vegas. And so he created this superhero persona for himself called the Phantom Patriot. And he got obsessed with the Bohemian Grove, which is a conspiracy theory that says that there's this place called the Bohemian Grove, which is a real place where the elite of the country go and commit child sacrifice. Now, they don't actually do that in real life, but they definitely are a secret society of celebrities. Walter Cronkite was one of them. I believe, what's his name? Frank Sinatra was one of them. Oh. There's a bunch of celebrities that are all part of that group.
It's a good group to be
but,
in.
Respect. But aside from the child sacrifice.
Outside of the reason they're all together,
So, but Richard McCaslin got so consumed with the idea that they were committing child sacrifice that he made a superhero costume for himself and broke into the compound and tried to burn it down. Like, he was a real life, like, vigilante dude. And, like, the police showed up and he almost killed a guy and he ended up going to prison for it. And then when he got out of prison, he made comics about being the Phantom Patriot and doing all this shit, moved to a compound out in the middle of nowhere, Las Vegas. And it's a very interesting story. And now I will stop talking about this. But Richard McCaslin's The Phantom Patriot, there's a really good book about him called American Madness, written by T. Carulos. Everybody should go read it if they're into this kind of shit, which I'm assuming if you're listening to a fucking comic book podcast about creators talking about comic books, this is the kind of shit you like.
Right now, there is a insane spike in that Google search right now for Richard McCaslin. Right? Maybe the most.
Nobody has thought about Richard McCaslin until I just said that. And they were like, ooh, Richard McCaslin. Ooh, yeah.
I'm actually, I quickly typed it into Google and I went to images and I'm seeing this. Yo, this is a costume straight out of a 1990s Captain America run. He might as well be the U.S. agent.
Yeah. And he made it too. And the crazy thing is he was doing this since like the 1980s and he had made multiple characters that he played. One of them was called Thought Crime, which is like this really, after he got out of prison, he rebooted the character and it was Thought Crime. And he had this giant exclamation point on his chest. And like, he wore like a jumpsuit with like white and black bars, like old, like 1950s style criminals. It's awesome. It's awesome. So cool.
Nicole, are you just used to like these random facts and stories that Dave has?
Oh yeah, I know most of this stuff already mostly because he's obsessed with it. Some of the stuff I like am as excited about as Dave. Some of this weird, off-brand superhero or whatever specific underground stuff. But this one is cool. I just don't know that much about it except for what Dave has told me.
Dave, are you just like chock full of these random facts because of the podcast that you run, Deep Cuts? Because this feels like a Deep Cuts episode right now.
It was a Deep Cuts episode, yes. But I was interested in... I've been interested in real-life superheroes since they first kind of started. It's just a very... I think it's a direct outgrowth of kind of the stuff that's happened since superhero movies got kind of, in air quotes, bigger, where people are like, oh, I can see Steve Rogers on screen punching a Nazi. I want to do that too, except there isn't really, well, there are Nazis to punch now and I recommend everyone punching them, but it's a lot harder to do that than just like give sandwiches to homeless people, you know, because that's what most real life superheroes have just become, is like, hey, I'm going to do some like, you know, local trash cleanup. Yeah. Which is great. That's cool.
You mean like really actually helping people?
Yeah. I don't really know if you need to wear a bulletproof vest to do that, but fuck it. Whatever. That's cool. Good for you.
I mean, it's definitely a good work, but it don't get your Wikipedia hype, you know?
That's true.
You know what does? Trying to burn down the fucking Bohemian Grove. That does.
Yeah. Look, and then we're going talking to prison. About him now.
Yeah. R.I.P.
And, you know, I owe a big part of this opportunity to chat with you two to Eli Schwab, who we had on the show last month. I think he helped us get connected shortly after that. Dave, I'm assuming you've got the relationship with Eli. How'd you meet Eli?
Couldn't even tell you. We've just known each other.
I met him. I used to work at a shop called Quest downtown in L.A. And he shopped there and I met him there. I don't know if you knew him already, Dave. But...
I knew him, I think, through Meltdown. I think. I really don't know. Eli's a great guy.
Oh, yeah.
Publishes Cosmic Lion comics.
Oh, look, he got an hour and a half last month to push his wares. So nah, Eli is a really good dude, man. It was my first time chatting with him. You know, I followed the cartoonist Kayfabe Ringside group that he runs, and I got the opportunity to chat with him last month, like I said, and it was just a good time. Dude's got a very magnetic personality, so
yeah,
I'm not surprised that he's pulled in some awesome creators like you too. But speaking of longtime associates, you know, I tried to do some self-research into what was the earliest body of work that you two had done, and really I came across a lot more than you know, a giant list. But I think that the earliest body of work I could find was something called, you know, This Is Not a Girl Gang. And I was curious, how long have you two really been working together, and how did you originally meet?
So we made This Is Not a Girl Gang in, I think, 2015. And it was actually our second comic that we ever did.
Oh, close.
The first one, yeah. The first one was, Dave has a book called Action Hospital, mm-hmm. which is kind of this sprawling story about a hospital that services superhuman being and people with special, usually mystical needs. But it has sort of a rotating cast of artists. Most of the characters are assigned to a specific artist. And so Dave and I did a 8-page story for that. And then I came back and drew that character at various pages and different stories for that one. So the first thing we did was called DeLorean Gray Mermaid Hunter. And it is a 8-page Action Hospital story about a basically an avenging lover whose boyfriend gets kidnapped by mermaids, and he has to go and try and get him back.
And any time that you have to say DeLorean Gray Mermaid Hunter, I just get so happy. This is the dumbest shit we've ever made, and I love it so much.
Yeah, it's a good one. But that was kind of really my first comic that wasn't like a single page. So we started there, and then This Is Not a Girl Gang is it's like 3-panel strip mini comics about 2 girls who go on road trips and just kind of what their experiences is as they go, and funny little jokes. And it's like one big story, but told in 1-page, 3-panel strips. And there's 2 of them, actually. We did one that is a trip to the Grand Canyon, and one that is a train trip to the Pacific Northwest, where they basically get stuck on a train for like 36 hours due to a miscalculation in train tickets.
No, I spent a good part of my, was it Friday? It was either Friday or Saturday, going down a rabbit hole on your website, Nicole. So kudos on having a very seamless and like easy to navigate website that looks good. And you have all of those like comics on there, which I guarantee, I'm pretty sure I counted, it was like 95%, you know, projects between you and Dave, all of the, yeah. them being like super stellar, you know, really like quaint, heartfelt, like slice of life stories. And I had a good time with all of them. Bubbles is one that I really enjoyed. And your fear of flying, the flight one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Bad drawings about flying.
Yeah,
bad
yeah.
drawings about on airplanes or something. Yeah.
It was a good time. So I guess thank you for providing me with plenty of entertainment during the research process. It was like some of the most fun research I've done in a minute.
No problem. I mean, those mini comics are so fun to do. And we were self-publishing almost completely for probably like 4 years. Hmm. And so I had a lot more time to make mini comics, and last year we didn't do any, but we do a lot of conventions. So I like to make little things that we can sell and people can take home with them that are smaller and cheaper. And it's been a while since I made a little mini comic like that. So I think I probably should sit down and do one of those. When you're working on 2 books full time, it's a little bit hard to find the time to do stuff like that. But now I have a little bit of space. I could do some more of those.
Dave, can you recall what was going through your head when you first saw Nicole's artwork?
Yes, very much so. Yes. I don't know if you know this story and you're setting me up for it, but it's a good story.
I try to be a good host. You know, behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So I met Nicole at a gallery showing because a bunch of we have mutual friends in common. And after the gallery show, we all went out to a restaurant together. We having dinner, you know, a bunch of cartoonists. And like illustrators tend to do, we started playing a little like exquisite corpse game where everyone would draw on a piece of paper or a napkin and pass it around. And I did a drawing of a guy like flexing like this, and Nicole took it and she put a shake weight in the guy's hand. And that's the moment when I was like, this bitch. All right. All right. All right. Let's do it. Okay. All right.
While an old couple sung karaoke in the background.
Yeah, it was like a karaoke barbecue place. So there was like people eating barbecue, Nicole drawing a shake weight, and an old couple doing "Carry On My Wayward Son" or some bullshit behind us. That was the moment where I was like, oh, okay, all right, I see how it is. Okay, let's make some shit. All right, let's do this. And then Nicole was like, I don't know, and I was like, no, come on. Let's fucking
what if I had drawn like what if I had drawn I don't know a pineapple instead of a shake weight? Would we be making
comics? No, probably not.
I can speak for that. Nah, the shake weight is just the shake weight says, okay, she gets it. Like outside of the box thinking, like, and it fits. It's like, huh? Okay, you could have drawn anything, but shake weight.
The key to life really is the shake weight.
The shake weight, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I really should invest in the shake weight. You gotta get my drawing arm stronger.
Yeah. Seeing like how seamless you two work together and what you guys put out in the world, you know how good it is. It made me think about like other exceptional comic book duos. So like names like, you know, Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, you know, Marv Wolfman, George Perez. Like those names come together when you think of like that writer artist combo that just you can't
Quietly and Morrison.
Yeah, yeah. Quietly and Morrison. Yeah, thank you.
The Tamakis.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, it kind of leads me to my question. I wanted to know, are there comic book duos that you guys look up to or revere in that light?
The Tamakis. Hands down.
Jillian and Mariko Tamaki,
hands down.
Oh, I was going to say, and you're a big Phillips Brubaker fan.
Oh, come on.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I'm actually disappointed I did not have that as the first, because I've gone on saying on record on this show, Brubaker and Sean Phillips are probably the best comic book duo. If not the best, definitely top five. There's no way you can not tell me not top five.
Yeah. I mean, for me, my Mount Rushmore of the duos are like it's the Tamakis and then Morrison and Quietly and then Jack Kirby and Jack Kirby. Like
I know why you say that for sure. I give you that.
I mean, look, man, I know a lot of people like the Marvel stuff that he did. I do too, but to me, I like Jack's solo work.
Oh yeah,
New Gods. I love that guy.
Oh, for sure.
But yeah, the big two though, I think for me personally, are Morrison and Quietly and Mariko and Jillian Tamaki. And really, honestly, like in terms of what Nicole and I make, it's the Tamakis. Tamaki.
Yeah.
Like, you know, their emphasis on character, their obsession with or really Jillian's obsession with breaking down time into these big sustaining moments that are very small and minute, but obviously mean something to the characters. You know, I think those are very admirable and exciting things and Super Mutant Magic Academy. Poor Vita, please.
Well said. Nicole, who's on your Mount Rushmore of comics?
I mean, he took mine, really. It's Jillian and Mariko Tamaki for sure. If we're talking just generally around Mount Rushmore and not duos, Eleanor Davis is up there. Obviously, Mizaki is up there. There's a comics trio who are French artists named Bastien Vives, the other two, I know their names, Balric. There's two other dudes. They make a book called Last Man that's this French, it's a fight comic. It's structured like a manga, and every issue is a different style of fight comic. So it's like The first one's like a medieval fantasy thing. The second one is like a Mad Max thing. The third one is a Vegas wrestling thing. And they're all one story with the same characters kind of like moving in and out of these different environments. And the facility that the three of them have and the way that they all draw together and work together, it is so fluid and you can't tell who's doing what at all. It's a really incredible working relationship. And they're so fast too. Hmm. It's amazing how fast they are. But those guys have a partnership that is just kind of mind blowing to me that they can kind of integrate that well together.
Bastien Vives, even just by himself, is just like,
yes, he's incredible.
Who the fuck are you? Like a human hand made this? It's I'm not to take away them as a unit because the last
Solik, Solik and Son Levy are the other two. I don't want to like not say their names.
Not to say that the other two aren't vitally important to the Last Man process, mm-hmm. but Bastien Vives's other books are also
amazing.
It's like watching a swimmer, you know, like when there's like, I can swim, I've been in a pool, and then you watch somebody in the Olympics and it's just like, holy fuck, they're going like 40 miles an hour through water. How is that possible?
That's what his drawing is.
I'm not sure there's anyone else who makes it look as easy as he does. The thing is that they look like they take no effort, but they are so well thought out, so fluid, so every line is in the right place. And they're like kind of messy sometimes, depending. Every book is in a slightly different style, but there is just really something about it that looks like he just like scribbles it. It's a beautiful illustration. It's very frustrating.
Yeah,
I just made
him and Loic Locatelli.
No, I just made a note to check this out. It's one of my favorite things, getting to interview creators, is seeing their influence and picking up on things that maybe I'm not awake to. So thank you for sharing that. That was good. I wanted to thank both of you for sending me an advanced copy of Everyone is Tulip, the comic that we're here to chat about. I read it on vacation, and I thought it was a fantastic read that served as a refreshing palate cleanser, especially compared to like the typical comic stuff that I've been reading, you know, for the show in these last few months. So it was enjoyable to be able to read something completely different than my usual stack. Dave, I thought your dialogue and pacing made for a seamless and very grounded and believable story. Like at no point did I ever feel like it took me out of Becca's world. It only enhanced it. Nicole, your attention to detail and care you give to each character to ensure a very like distinct personality made for a visually appealing experience. And I got to say, your wardrobes that you created for these characters might solidify this comic as the most fashionable comic I've ever read. Like it's like, yo, where is she getting these designs from? Some of your like 9-panel pages were like, holy shit. I wouldn't be surprised if someday in the future someone looks at this book and is like, oh, I've got the magic right here. I got the key. I'm making a whole fashion line based on this. No, it's good stuff.
If somebody goes out there and makes an Everyone is Tulip fashion line based on my drawings, I won't even be mad. Like, take all the rights. I don't care. I just want to see it exist. Yeah, that would be amazing.
Some of it is super wicked. I spent a good bit of time like, oh man, this is, you know, some shit that Kanye West wishes he could make. but I was curious.
fuck you Yeezus. Come at me with your trash bag ass looking shit. I shouldn't kick the guy. He's getting divorced. He's mentally, you know, he's a little unstable. He's bipolar. He's unmedicated. Yeah, but you know what?
He's in Wyoming.
He got a lot of money to make up for it.
So I was curious, what comics or other media were you two consuming when creating this comic that served as either an influence or inspiration?
Yeah, so Everyone is Tulip follows a young actor from Arizona who moves to Los Angeles to try and break into the world of Hollywood and gets sucked up into the high-stakes world of YouTube performance art, which is a real thing. And the book itself is kind of about the the idea of artistic compromise and like how far are you willing to go to get what you want. And so the themes in the book were inspired by real people and some real life influencers. The aesthetic of the book was kind of inspired by a few things. One of them being the Nicholas Winding Refn movie, Neon Demon. Also, we had talked about a lot of Satoshi Kon's films early in the process, like Millennium Actress and Perfect Blue were two that we kind of... Because originally the story was going to be a little bit more like Millennium Actress or Perfect Blue, and that Tulip and Becca were going to be two separate characters, not more of this kind of like persona that she plays on the internet. Am I leaving anything out, Nicole? I don't know. Is there other stuff? There is other stuff. I'm just not
remembering. those are the main ones. When we started talking about the book, it was because we had gotten into watching some videos from a bunch of different YouTube stars who were kind of becoming really popular at the time. So there was people like there's a bunch of these weird kind of Dada-esque video makers, things like Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared, which is like a Muppet storytelling thing that's adult themed and very strange. And there's another a Russian performance artist named Dalvita, who does these very, again, like other strange videos, and they all have these sort of like kind of pretty blatant anti-capitalist messages on them. But we were observing all of these different people and how they kind of were going from being, you know, just normal people making a thing to viral overnight, basically, you know, these things. And the way that you can become famous and the rate at which you can become famous now has really changed. So a lot of the inspiration came directly from these real people who are making the stuff. And the aesthetic of the book is pretty directly inspired by some of the stuff that they make. Definitely Neon Demon, definitely Perfect Blue. We were all talking about all these things. And like Dave said, it was going to be initially more of a kind of loss of self, break from self-identity, break from the person making the thing and the character of the thing. And it kind of shifted away from that a little bit, but I think there are elements of that that are still there. Becca and Tulip are the same person, but also those lines get blurred when you become famous like that. People think that you are this character or you are that person. And as someone who's making that thing, you kind of have to hold on to your self-identity or else you might lose it completely.
And Dave, you just brought it up, but I noticed it was also in the Dark Horse press release. But you mentioned that this project is a deeply personal work for you and that it was mined from experience, both personal and observed. Can you share some of those experiences that you were drawing from? And have you, or maybe Nicole, have you guys ever been in a situation similar to what Becca is faced in the story?
Yo, this is Botter. Sorry for interrupting this episode, but I'll keep it brief. I wanted to let you know about a massive sale we have going on over at the Short Box Store on all of our merchandise and apparel. That's theshortboxstore.bigcartel.com. You can now save 20% off your entire order using the discount code YO, Y-O-O. So if you've been waiting for the right time to finally buy that gauntlet snapback, or if you ever wanted to buy any of the shirts you see me wear on the podcast, well, now's your chance to get them for a steal. We still have a few sizes left of everything, but they won't last long. And once they're gone, they are gone. And then I mentioned that all of our apparel is screen printed on high quality material. None of that heat transfer or direct to garment stuff. Our shirts are some of the most comfortable ones you'll ever wear. And the hats look even better in person. So wear your support for the Short Box Nation proudly, knowing that you're going to look damn good doing it. Get to theshortboxstore.bigcartel.com as soon as you can. And don't forget to use that discount code YO, Y-O-O, to save 20% off your entire order. All of this information can be found in this episode's show notes if you want to get there faster. Thanks for not pressing fast forward. Now back to the show.
Yeah, so my day job, shocker of all shockers, is not in comics because there's no fucking money in comics.
It'll break your heart, right?
I know, right? Mm-hmm. So my day job is I work in new media. I write for a media company that has a couple different shows. So I write on a Snapchat show. I write on a couple of YouTube shows. And the kind of paradigm that the character of Tulip and the character of Becca live in is something that I have to deal with every day. So it's very, you know, for better or for worse, experiential. I think the book is, you know, honestly pretty deeply autobiographical in that I am not trying to be an actor, but the struggle of maintaining artistic integrity in the face of a yawning chasm of indifference and struggle is something that every artist is intimately familiar with, and something Nicole and I have to navigate very frequently. You know, it's, you know, our crucible typically is this YouTube video that I'm dressed as a chair in going to go viral. but you know, it's not dissimilar that when you're dealing with companies and the contracts negotiations are stressful and, you know, maybe there are different, desires and designs on the things that you make. And, you're like, yeah, but this isn't really what I was setting out to say. And there's cooks in the kitchen that don't care.
How do you draw the line in the sand when it comes to keeping like a sense of artistic integrity?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
You're like still trying to figure
that
it out.
Really is. It is one of the major questions that we're bringing up in the book. But also it's something that there is no one answer to that. Every artist has to figure out what their line is, their personal line. And also that can change from project to project. You know, there are certain times when you make exceptions because you want to get ahead and you have these hard and fast rules of, I never do this, I never do that, I would never work for this person, but then some opportunity comes up that's really good and might really help you. And you have to then sit there and decide, you know, is it worth it for me to give up my, or maybe temporarily give up my moral values that I thought I was holding in order to get ahead, to then be able to re-implement those values or have the career that I want or whatever it is. And the trick is deciding which of those opportunities are worth it and which of them are not, and navigating those situations in a way that feels true to yourself without giving up too much. And that is kind of the major dilemma of our main character, Becca. She kind of has to decide what it is that she wants out of the path that she's taken and what she's willing to, you know, kind of put up with or give up for it.
Yeah. And I think Becca too, as a character is, you know, I think there are two types of people that work in creative industries. There are people that are running away from something and people who are running towards something. And in our book, there's an ensemble of characters who some of them are combinations of those two. Some of them are decidedly one or the other. And I think Becca is probably somebody who's running away from something. And I think that that informs her decisions and her ability to navigate those situations in a very specific manner. You know,
she's someone who's running away, but thinks she's running towards.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Completely.
And on the topic of that, those are some of my favorite panels and pages within the book was, you know, those flashback scenes, seeing where Becca comes from and what she's supposedly running from. And I thought, Nicole, you did a masterful job as far as distinguishing that with the art. You know, it is very clear what's taking place in the current time and then what's taking place as a flashback.
A lot of the distinction between kind of our modern day current timeline and those flashbacks really has to do with the color. And our colorist, Ellie Hall, did just an amazing job. We worked together a lot on kind of the overall look of the book and some of the kind of broader thematic things. You know, we have the internet is represented by this kind of blue light. The modern day stuff is mostly kind of these neutral pinks, and all the flashback stuff is this kind of subdued purple color. But the way that Ellie implemented it is really just, she did an amazing job. It really would be a different book if we hadn't had her on.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And I think that a lot of that stuff, it's interesting to see how it kind of evolved, right? Like, I think that, you know, when you're looking at a finished piece, it's easy to be like, oh, this is how that connects, and this is what this means. But it's not always, you don't always know those things when you're doing it. And then as over the course of making it, you start realizing those traits and then going back and like filling them in and like making sure that all of those beginnings and ends, the grace notes connect. And that's what was really, really cool, you know, with the three of us working on this, but, you know, really them working on it. Like I did my part and then they worked on it for 2 years or whatever.
How much time did you spend writing the story and developing the characters, Dave?
I don't know exactly. Basically, it started because of some conversations that we had had. We were at a convention in England, and we started talking about this idea of, like, we had just finished Fuck Off Squad, and we were like, what are we going to do next? And then Nicole had been drawing some of these internet people just as, like, character studies or, you know, just doodles or whatever. And I was like, maybe there's something there. And we kind of started talking about this idea of, you know, a influencer comic that would be kind of like a Satoshi Kon movie. And then I think probably, like, you know, after that 2 weeks of us really talking about it, like every day, all day, when we got back, I think I wrote it pretty quickly. I would say, you know, we did three, maybe four drafts. And I would say from beginning to, you know, from me typing panel one to me typing panel nine on the last page for the, you know, fourth draft or whatever, I think probably 3 months, maybe.
And it sounds like, and it sounds like, you know, there's a lot for, you know, fellow artists and creators to think on and chew on, you know, when reading this book. But was there any other maybe specific or ideal audience that you had in mind when creating the story?
I'm really, it's just anybody who is currently participating in the internet. You know, I think that this aspect touches everybody's lives, not always in the same way, but in some way. And it's really hard to be a person in 2021 and not be affected by this weird world that we're all kind of sucked into 24/7 on the internet. You know, you can do your best to extricate yourself from it, but so many of us, especially creatives, don't have a choice. We have to utilize it for self-promotion. We have to utilize it for connection because we're all alone in our apartments drawing. You have to utilize it for all these different things. I have to utilize it to get places, you know, like we're all glued to our phones all the time. And I think the combination of this being just a really significant part of our other everyday life, and then also these other aspects of anybody who makes something, I think is going to be able to relate to this. Anybody who makes something that is not just them in their room alone making something. Like, it's one thing to go, Dave and I used to obviously self-publish stuff, and we could make whatever we wanted. You just go, you make the thing, you put it out, and then it's done. And that's an amazing way to make things. But if you want to have a broader audience, sometimes you need to work with these bigger companies and corporations who are going to want to say in what it is that you're making. And they were going to want to dictate kind of your path to a certain extent. And anybody who's had to take something really personal that they are putting their heart into making and, you know, try and commercialize it, try and make it available to a broader public or work with a publisher or work with a corporation, I think that that is really going to speak to them as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the coin of the realm in almost any artistic pursuit is compromise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As much as I don't want it to be. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the reality of the situation.
How do you make something that you feel is true to yourself while still putting food on the table and paying your rent? You know, it is the ultimate dilemma for artists. You have to make those compromises you know, particularly with something like comics, where it is innately a commercial medium. It's not like fine art, which has its own whole mess of complicated stuff and consumerism based around that. But specifically, comics has always been a consumerist medium. And so you kind of can't extricate the process of making comics from selling comics. Hmm. There are people who do. I mean, not if you want to do it on a large scale. Anyway, obviously you can just go, anybody can go make a comic and it's the most wonderful thing. But in order to really have kind of that broader range, it's all about money and time. Because it takes forever.
You know, there's a scene in the comic that kind of spoke to me, and I wanted to ask you guys about it. But it's where Becca is really starting to, you know, see her fame and her, you know, clout, for lack of better terms, really start to rise. And, you know, she starts reading the comments underneath all of her posts and these videos that's making her famous. And she quickly learns, you know, rule number one, don't ever read the fucking comments. And I was curious, as two creators and artists yourselves who, you know, your work is out there for public consumption, but also, you know, the flip side of that, you know, critique as well, whether it be welcomed or unwelcomed. I was curious, how do you two keep yourself grounded when it comes to, you know, receiving or getting commentary and critiques like that?
Blockchains, mostly. I mean, you know, there's a reason that line is in the book. Don't read the fucking comments. Because there are going to be people in your life with legitimate opinions that matter, that have something to say, who can help you grow your work. Those people are not the people who are saying mean comments on the internet. It just, it's two different things. And so I would never say don't take criticism, don't take feedback, don't do any of those things. But be careful about where you're taking those things. So if it's just randos on the internet, maybe don't give that as much weight, unless it's someone being like, hey, this thing was racist and you might want to address that. You know, that's a different thing, obviously. But when it's just like, I had a bunch of comments when Shadow of the Batgirl came out, which was just a bunch of superhero dude bros being like, why doesn't she have boobs?
I mean, this is like, YA novel, you asshole.
Yeah, she's 16. Like, a lot of, they don't have boobs yet. Like, get over it. You know, so, you know, I could have, there were a lot of people who were like, I don't like this art because it doesn't look like main DCU, because it's literally not. It literally isn't made for you, 40-year-old man. And I could read all those things and say like, oh, look at all these people who don't like what I made. And I could take that to heart and I could be really upset about it. Or I could just block it, not pay attention to that, because I know that the comments that are being made are not actually about the quality of the thing. It's about a misunderstanding of who that thing is for. So it's really about kind of picking and choosing where you take your criticism and what you pay attention to.
And Nicole and I both, like, I mean, I agree with everything Nicole said. I mean, I wrote Star Trek comics, for fuck's sake. So you think those guys, like,
oh man,
Star Trek people are a very specific type of person. And I was very fortunate in that my thing was very positively reviewed. Everybody liked it. You know, I feel like I dodged a bullet on that one. But, you know, Nicole and I's collaborative process now is we kind of have this ritual. We go to this park near her house and we play catch and we talk about story and we talk about what we liked about how our previous books worked and what we didn't like, what we thought worked, what we thought didn't work, what we thought I could do better, what we thought Nicole could do better. So, you know, I'm not saying that we like rake each other over the coals or something. Like we're, you know, it's a partnership. We're trying to grow, but you know, absent art school, you know, the two of us are kind of the Greek chorus, you know, where if we both agree on something, it's probably true. If we both disagree with something, it's probably not something we're going to pursue. If we're split down the middle, then whoever cares the most wins. That's kind of usually the way it goes. And a lot of conversations about like, oh, I wish that the book had had more of insert X here while playing catch in the park happens a lot, where it's just like, I really just wish we could have nailed this aspect of it. And I just really feel like the writing didn't really communicate that. Or, oh man, I really wish this moment had in the script was so great. And I just when it came time to draw it, just for whatever reason, it didn't really work the way I thought it was going to work. And then, you know, but that doesn't ever happen though, because Nicole's amazing. We've never actually had that conversation. But
never. I never do anything wrong.
That sounds like a healthy balance though. It's like you guys aren't resting on your laurels, but at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, you guys are having like that kind of lessons learned kind of powwow. That enhances
trying to, you know, it's a little hard sometimes to know how other people perceive it. But there's also at a certain point, it almost doesn't matter what other people think because mm-hmm. it's, you're really making it for yourself. You know what I mean? Like you're trying to, you know, I love Werner Herzog. I love Werner Herzog. And I specifically love his movie, Fitzcarraldo, the movie where he basically, if you haven't seen the movie, it's amazing. You should go out and see it. But the high concept of the movie is he wanted to make a movie about a rubber baron in the 1800s who was going to take a ship, like a ferry, over a mountain in the Amazon jungle and build an opera house deep in the Amazon jungle. He pitched it to Fox. He had a deal, a 3-picture deal at Fox. They're like, great, let's do it. That sounds like a weird artistic movie. Let's fucking do it, bro. And he was like, awesome. We will go to the Amazon. And they were like, no. We're going to shoot that shit on the back lot here in California. And he was like, we will not have these plastic solutions. And he went to the Amazon jungle and spent 8 years of his life filming a literal ship over a mountain. They shot the movie in order and took a 2-ton ferry over a mountain. And this is the craziest shit. They had to stop in the middle because Mick Jagger had to go on tour. So they pulled the ship down to the bottom of the fucking mountain again, recast the role, and did it again. He pulled that fucking 2-ton boat over a mountain twice.
Yeah, it's Mike Drop.
And that's what I'm saying is he often says no plastic solutions, you know, and I completely agree with that. I think that there is it at a certain point you're pursuing the idea that is the most perfect version of the idea. Are you going to fall short? Yes, but you can't start out not pursuing the perfect version of the thing, because then you get dragged back and dragged back, and then you end up in this awful quicksand of compromise. And mm-hmm. You know, for better or for worse, Nicole and I, 9 times out of 10, we tend to see the same vision of this is the perfect version of the book. And that's you know, that's exciting to me. I think it's important. I think I you know, it's going back to when you were talking before about comics duos, right? Like there's a shared vision behind those people's work that's exciting to read, because you can feel there's a chemistry there. There's an alchemy that doesn't exist when pair A-list artist with A-list writer.
Like something much deeper.
Yeah, it really is. Like, I mean, even just the difference between when Mark Miller and Brian Hitch were making the Ultimates, and when Brian Bendis and Brian Hitch were making the Age of Ultron thing, you can tell that Brian Hitch doesn't want to do things that Brian Bendis wants to do. And they're both amazing craftsmen, but Brian Hitch is just like, I don't want to draw this much dialogue, bro. This is too many people
talking
in Yiddish.
That's exactly what he wrote to Bendis. Bro, chill on the dialogue, please.
Yeah, I don't want to fucking do this shit. But when you pair Alex Maleev mm-hmm. with Brian Bendis, you get something else. You get a magic there. Even when Alex Maleev is tracing photos, it's still more interesting. Like there's a chemistry. There's a je ne sais quoi. Mm.
Well said.
If you were to look at the scripts that I get from Dave versus the scripts that he gives to other people that maybe he hasn't worked with as much, or other duos who make stuff, a lot of it is written for me in a way that, you know, there's a lot of stuff kind of left out because I already know what it is. We have his shorthand. We don't need descriptors. We've already talked about what the book needs to be, what it needs to look like. I'm not getting, I mean, occasionally there's a little like scene direction, but I'm not getting panel descriptions. I'm not getting this or that. It's all, you know what to do. Mm-hmm. Go do it. You know, it's dialogue. It's a little bit of setup. It's a lot. Occasionally it's like, do whatever you want here. We're going to do this something atmospheric, you know, and then I'll just go do it.
Or sometimes it's very granular. Like, all right, so I've got this idea about these cell phones and we're going to do 9-panel grids. And in the cell phones, in the 9-panel grids, we're going to do alternating cell phone pages. Mm. So it's going to be this very rhythmic thing where everything's going to be designed. But I also don't need to outline every one of those designs to her. I'm just like, okay, this one's a cell phone. This one's a narrative one. This one's a cell phone. This one's a narrative one. And then we both know, oh, the cell phones make a diamond shape. Don't do a different layout. It needs to be a grid because the cell phones make a diamond in this one or whatever. Like, you know, there's a lot of, we just know the ideas because we've talked about them so much.
And how long do you think it took, or would you say it took for you guys to hit that rhythm? And did it come relatively seamless, or was there a lot of learning opportunities between you two?
I think the main learning was me learning how to make comics, unfortunately, because I've been drawing all my life. I went to art school. I have a BFA in illustration, but the language of sequential comics and the skills required to just make an illustration are two pretty different skills. So because I just needed to kind of sit down, read a bunch of comics and make some stuff, and I made most of them with Dave, my understanding of comics and my personal comics language comes from a combination of reading as much as I could get my hands on, plus making comics with Dave. So a lot of that, the way that I make things is built on the way that we do things together. I obviously do stuff with other people. I make stuff, I write my own stuff, but a lot of that really early learning experiences of like, this is how you set up panels. This is how you tell a story. Like a lot of that learned on the job with Dave. And so there was some, you know, speed bumps in the beginning, but it was mostly me just being like, how do I do this?
Yeah, learning curve.
And then once I figured out how to make a comic, we were already at a place where we were spending a ton of time together. We were talking about comics all the time. And so that language just kind of developed as I learned how to make comics, really. And the other thing is that a lot of our stories kind of start, they either start of like, what if we did a story about this thing? Or they start with, I had this formalist idea for a way to do something, cell phones or captions or this or that. How do we build a story around that? How do we make a story that relates to the idea of this thing? And so that it makes sense, that it's integral to the story that we're telling, instead of just dropping in some formalist thing into a random story. How do we make that thing an essential part of the story that we're trying to tell? So a lot of that stuff gets built in super early into the process. We've talked about it so much by the time Dave even writes a script that it's just kind of like, I don't need him to be like, this is how you do it, because we've already, that's where the idea came from. We've already talked about it.
And Dave, because Nicole, I think pretty much answered the next question I had, which was, you know, what are some strengths that that Dave possesses as a writer and collaborator? So I'll flip it, because we've given Dave a lot of love. Let's go ahead and flip it. And Dave, let me ask you, what are some strengths and characteristics that Nicole possesses that makes her a unique artist or collaborator?
Well, I think
Nicole's like, bring it on. Don't skimp.
What you got?
Don't skimp on it.
No, I think there's a bunch of things. One, I think Nicole has a very interesting visual language, like her narrative voice, in air quotes, that illustrative style that she draws in is very appealing to look at. I mean, if I had my druthers, I would draw like Nicole draws. You know, I want to just draw stories about sad girls being alone and, you know, swiping on Tinder at 2 a.m. Like that's what I want to draw.
Sign me up.
But I'm not, my visual language is a little bit more specific in that I can't draw those things very well. I can only draw like robots and zombies and ninjas. You know what I mean? Like, I like, does it look like a Kamen Rider? Oh, well then I don't know how to draw that. I don't know how to make a bed interesting. If you want a wall of like weird technology with wires and computer screens, I can draw the fuck out of that. But drawing just a chair, how do you make a chair look cool? Nicole knows how to make a chair look cool. And that is the highest compliment that I can give another illustrator, is that their visual language is so concrete and defined and so specific and well-oiled and honed that they can draw a scene of people sitting on couches talking, and it's riveting. I mean, that's what most of the books that we make are. It's sad people in rooms talking. And, you know, those are my favorite comics. So, you know, This One Summer, Wet Moon by Sophie Campbell, like Blankets. Like, when I read Blankets in high school, I was just like, what the fuck is this? You know, and like, there's so much about the way that she can interpolate an abstract mundanity that is just so visually appealing. And then the flip side of that is that she's analytical enough to be able to know when is the right time to step in and make things hyper stylized, and when is the right time to kind of get out of the way and let the story be the story, you know? And she also works digitally, which allows us to do interesting things with stats. And like, I don't know that I would have written the cell phone mechanic that's in Everyone is Tulip if she was drawing traditionally. Like, you could do it. You could trace that cell phone over and over again and it would be fine. But I don't know that I would come up with the idea. There's a lot of stuff like that where, you know, her strengths become an aspect of a book we make, or my weaknesses become a aspect, or her weaknesses, where it's finding out what that math equation is, right? Like, thing Nicole likes to draw plus thing I'm interested in plus this weird thing that neither of us can get over equals interesting work.
Minus things we don't want to do.
Yeah, minus things we don't want to do.
What is
that making me draw cars?
Okay,
yeah.
So I was going to ask, what is high on that list of things that you guys don't want to do? You said don't draw cars. What are some other things?
Well, I know for Nicole, like, I would never write an action scene with guns. Like, I just wouldn't do that. Like, I know that she doesn't want to.
She's
do
groaning
that
right now.
At all?
No, yeah, like, I mean, I had to learn on the job for the action stuff in Shadow the Batgirl, but there were no guns in that. I don't know what it is about guns. Any like really detailed technology stuff, I just, most of my work is fairly fluid, and I'm good with the human form because it is soft and curvy. And anytime there's something really hard edged and exacting, I get really impatient with it.
You say that, but all of those library, you know, windows with giant cathedral stained glass and, you know, giant crowd scenes in Shadow of the Batgirl with all the, you know, the cityscape and everything, that shit was dope. So, you know, look out for our next book, Guns and Chases. That's totally what I'm going to pitch. We're going to go to Skybound and we're going to do a book called Guns and Chases. Uh-huh. And it's going to be about two cops. One is going to be named Gerald Gunn, and the other one's going to be named Chase Masters.
Chase Masters is an actual person.
No, Chase Masterson is a real person. She's an actor on Star Trek.
Damn it.
Chase Masters PS9. Is totally copyright free.
Nicole, I did want to piggyback off a compliment that Dave was giving you, and that's your attention to detail. You know, for like minutia things, you know, of course, enhanced the setting and the story. But I got to give you props on the splash pages in Everybody is Tulip. You know, I was reading it digitally, of course, and it was a lot of fun to, like, you know, to swipe through these sometimes like 3-4 part you know, splash pages, which, you know, I think is very unique for a story of this type, you know, this kind of interpersonal drama, you know, a coming of age kind of story. You don't see, well, at least I'm not used to seeing splash pages incorporated in something that's like a little more, you know, slower pace and tone. And I say that respectively, of course. So those were some of my favorite scenes, kind of just scrolling through and being able to, like, you know, and I think that's the benefit of digital sometimes, is that you can really kind of hone in on details because you can zoom in a lot easier. You know, you've got, you know, dedicated, mm-hmm. this dedicated screen to this one part of a panel. But yeah, your splash pages, which is plentiful throughout the entire book, are some gorgeous looking bodies of work. So kudos to that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's all, for me, that's all about pacing and taking time to acknowledge a moment and breathe and have atmosphere where it's, you know, you're the only real control that you have as a comics creator over the pace at which a reader is consuming your book is that page turn. And so if you are pulling apart your moments or cramming them in and putting 15 panels on a page, you know, that's where the control comes in and you get to decide how quickly things are happening, how slowly they're happening. And the splash pages and the double page spreads are really a way to just kind of be like, pay attention to this.
Oh yeah,
it's important.
Yeah, I honed in on when you said, you know, letting that moment breathe, and I think you definitely executed that well, Dave. I wanted to go back to something that you brought up. You mentioned like how your day job gave you plenty of perspective to play and incorporate into Everyone Is Tulip. I was curious if your physical location has anything to, you know, offer, you know, both of you being in Los Angeles, is it that much of a, I guess how accurate, I guess that's what I'm getting to, is how is that LA lifestyle portrayed in Everyone Is Tulip?
Yeah, yes to all of the above. Yeah, the book itself is about Los Angeles. The thing that I kind of like about Los Angeles the most is when I first moved here, I was kind of not prepared for the level of attempt that is just here. Everybody's trying to do something. Every barista's hustling some screenplay, or they're an indie game developer, or they're an opera singer, or they're a would-be professional skateboarder. Like, everybody's trying something. And that's something I really like. I think that's something that a certain type of personality would probably be beleaguered by, maybe. They might be worn down by the level of just kind of like people performing that they are a thing other than what they're paying the bills with. But to me, that's very kind of existentially calming, because I know that we're all in this together. Even, you know, the Uber Lyft driver that I'm in, the person next to me on the bus, the guy in, or girl behind me in line at Starbucks, everybody's trying to do something. And because of that, you get a very specific way that people interact here. Everybody slips into friendships very easily, but they don't typically go anywhere deep. There's a very kind of quick shorthand of, hey, how's it going? Oh, it's so great. Awesome. Yeah, cool. So I wanted to talk to you about the thing. And that kind of energy of the almost the negative side of it is it's kind of vapid, and there can be an insipid kind of malicious or inimical kind of clawing at everyone, trying to get something from everyone you meet. That is 100% a Los Angeles thing that is in the book very tangibly. I choose not to see it that way. I choose to see it as everyone here is trying to make something of themselves, and they're trying to succeed, and they're trying to manifest dreams. You know, they're trying to change their destinies through pure willpower. And that is something that I personally find very uplifting and exciting. And there is a read of the book where that is a very tangible DNA strand.
I can imagine it's probably, you know, coming from a relatively, you know, small, big city, I can imagine how tiring that could be, you know, moving to a new place, not knowing anyone, trying to form, you know, real genuine friendships, but maybe going through, you know, a few friendships that kind of fizzle out or just aren't genuine, you know, enough or, you know, nothing based on anything substantial. But it sounds like, you know, you both got pretty lucky and found a pretty good diamond in the rough and, you know, meeting each other and forming such a, you know, great working. And it seems like a very good personal friendship as well. Imagine those are both rare and very welcomed.
I think they are very rare, but I think there's a component of that too, that I am something of a bulldog. When I moved to Los Angeles, you know what I fucking did? I went to every comics meetup group in LA. I went to, I don't even know how many, hundreds of film mixers. I went everywhere to try and see people, understand the scene, get a sense of who everybody was, make friends. And I met a lot of really great people doing that. But a lot of that came from me putting myself in that situation. I think that's a thing where in other areas of the country, I think people naturally find each other a little bit easier. Where in LA, I think there's a sense of resentment that you really have to go out and look for those things, you know, because driving is so hard here. Getting from place to place is so hard here. Being outside is hard because it's hot all the time. It's
beautiful here.
I mean, it's hot as fuck for me. So maybe I'm just not wealthy enough to afford air conditioning. Hey!
I mean, there are certain parts of the summer where it is very hot, but generally it is beautiful here.
Yeah.
Nicole, did you have to, from an artist's perspective, is it just as much effort for you as an artist to you know, meet other peers and get work going? Like, do you have to be a bulldog, like Dave mentioned?
Oh, yeah, I'm awful at it. Dave basically forced me into being his friend. It's a little different because I'm from Southern California. Dave is from Arizona, and he moved here, and he has this a little bit of an outsider view of the city. But I grew up here, and I went to school here. I went to school in Long Beach. So I have a little bit more of kind of just a basis of people that I already know and have relationships with and can interact with. But the main thing for me in terms of kind of forging working relationships has been being in comics, because, you know, it can be hard to make friends here. You have to be willing to go out and do stuff and blah, 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 and all that stuff that Dave just said. And a lot of the relationships that people make can tend to be a little surface level, or this idea of like, I'm friends with you because I think you're going to get me this, or in the long term, you could get me that, or whatever. But the comics community and going to shows, Dave and I over the last few years, except for 2020 and 2021 now, I guess, we've gone to basically as many shows as we possibly could. And we have made so many friends. Unfortunately, most of them live in other parts of the country. But I feel like particularly in indie comics, people are so supportive. They're so kind. They're so willing to help you, to give you, you know, I had this job that I couldn't do. Do you want it? Do you want to apply for this? I saw this opportunity. Do you think that would work for you? All these kinds of things. And it's a really, really welcoming community. You know, I went to art school and I've had a lot of friends there, and compared to, you know, my high school, I was like, these are my people. I love this. Like, these people actually understand me. And then college ended and everybody kind of dispersed. And then you're kind of back out on your own again, where it's like, oh, well, now I have to find people within this new, I moved to LA and some people moved to LA, but other people moved to other places. So you've got to reform a community for yourself. And comics really has been that for me. Dave actively went out and found it and went to Drink and Draws and did all this stuff. I found it by making stuff. You know, I went to a couple of Drink and Draws with Dave and that was great or whatever, but like, we found it by going to conventions, talking to people at the table, talking to people on the internet through Twitter and through Instagram and all that stuff, people who are doing the same things that we're doing, trying for the same stuff that we're trying for. And I feel like I kind of have sidestepped the quote unquote stereotypical idea of what LA is, because we, a lot of the characters in our book are this sort of, I don't want to say they're stereotypes because they're not, but there's this idea of a certain type of people who live in LA and work in LA. And there are a lot of those people. But there are also a lot of really genuine, hardworking people just striving, and particularly the ones who, I hate to say this, but particularly the ones who are from here and are not pursuing a creative industry, you know, because there's just such a like frenetic energy about the industry because everybody is striving for one spot, you know, and everybody is willing to push someone out of their way for the one spot. So when you end up talking to these people who are not trying for that one spot and they're just trying to kind of live their life and be a person in LA or wherever they are, it's a little bit easier to kind of forge some real relationships. And even though comics is that way, we are all fighting for one spot, it's much more supportive. And everybody's excited when someone else gets a job and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Wow, that's really reassuring to hear. Thank you for offering that perspective. Dave, I wanted to go to you real quick because you had posted a tweet on Friday while I was doing my research that really piqued my...
Oh, God, what did I do? Oh, God!
It's good.
Butter, are you going to fucking cancel me, bro? What the fuck did I do?
Never that, Dave. Eli gave you the seal of approval, so you know I got your back, baby. But you posted something that piqued my interest because I'm always interested in the business side of comics. So, like, that side of comics that you don't get to see or see vocalized a lot by creators such as yourself. And I was hoping maybe you could elaborate on it just a little more. I think it came in response to a topic that was dominating a comic Twitter last week in regard to piracy in comics. It looks like you might remember what you wrote. You wrote, though, the only comics piracy I stay up at night thinking about are the comic book pirates who loop creators into 50-50 IP farm deals. Those are the real pirates. And I took this as, you know, an indie comic creator putting the spotlight on a much bigger issue, though not trying to denounce the issue of comic piracy, but, you know, taking a step back and zooming out and saying, well, this is also a major problem. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more on that.
Yeah, sure. I'm so relieved that it is this and not something else that I remember tweeting.
I'm glad you didn't go back to my 2010 tweets, thankfully. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah. It would be a surprise to me because I low-key don't have a long-term memory. So you could just say things to me and I'd be like, I tweeted that? No. Yeah, so the question that you just read, it was full context. A couple weeks ago or a week ago, whenever it was, on Twitter, everybody was having... There's like three debates that comics Twitter has.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, who's more important, the writer or the artist? And then this one, is comics piracy good or bad? And like, there's like one or two other ones, which I don't even need to get into right now. But the point that I was trying to make is that there is a whole wing of the direct market, most publishers, quite frankly, in the direct market that have 50-50 IP split deals that are marketed as purely creator-owned, which I don't think most people understand.
No.
Everything that Vertigo Comics has ever published was a 50-50 deal, barring a few exceptions from A-list talent that were able to, you know, put their thumb on the scale, like Grant Morrison or Garth Ennis or something like that. Big-name creators like that, they sometimes are able to maintain 100% creator ownership. Most of the books that Vertigo has ever published were 50-50 deals. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, 50% of $1 million is still a lot. Like, that, if it becomes this huge TV thing, like, that could be great. And maybe, but the issue at hand is that there are a wing of publishers that publish works specifically with the point of leveraging these books into future film or television adaptations. Most of these publishers have first look deals at production companies or studios, and they are attempting to content mine these books, which then factors in three ways. One, when these contracts say that they're 50-50 splits, they don't actually position it that way. What they do is they say, you own the copyright, but three paragraphs down, we split any money that comes from film revenue 50-50. We split any money that comes from television revenue, 50-50, video game, 50-50, merchandising, 50-50. And the other component of that is that they, by default, have the decision power. Most of these contracts don't allow creator approvals. They're just, say, 50-50. Well, there is no... It's not 51, it's 50-50, which means the controlling interest is by default with the company. Hmm. So creators are not in control of these books that are being marketed as creator-owned, in air quotes. So, you know, you have whole publishers where their entire line is based off of exclusively, from my perspective, ripping people off. You know, it's literal piracy to me. Like, I see all of these companies publishing rafts of books from creators who may or may not fully understand what they're getting themselves into. And, you know, maybe they become Netflix TV shows, maybe they don't. But whatever's going to happen, the creators are not going to have any say in that. Hmm. And all of these publishers pitch it as, oh, we're going to have a partnership together. We're going to work together in tandem to make this, you know, mutually beneficial. And it's like, why isn't everybody a Robert Kirkman then?
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, Robert Kirkman's out there front and center. And that's a whole other conversation. But I'm just saying, the Image deal meant that Robert Kirkman and his various collaborators owned their work. I don't see anybody that published any books at Oni or Vault or Aftershock or, you know, any of the other companies that are doing this front and center, because they're not, because the company is the thing that is what they're, you know, leveraging. And it's depressing and it's fucked up, and it speaks to a long legacy of comics gangsterism.
Hmm.
You know, most comic book publishers were founded by gangsters. Most people don't know that. But like National Publications, which later became DC, was literally a rum-running money laundering scheme. Like it's really depressing. And it's not going away anytime soon. Because everybody's just kind of accepted it, because people are, everybody in comics is trying to mitigate failure. Nobody's planning for success. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who've signed these deals because they're like, well, it's never going to come to anything. I don't know anyone in Hollywood. I don't have any connections in that world. I'm not going to be able to leverage any of these books to be adapted. It's like, that's not the fucking point. Do you think fucking Siegel and Schuster knew anybody in Hollywood? No, they made an 8-page comic. They made an 8-page comic and it changed the world. And nobody wants to believe in themselves to that level. And I'm not even saying that from like an egotist standpoint where I'm like, I think that Tulip is going to fucking change the globe. Like I maybe it will. That'd be great. But I'm not planning for that. But you know what I am planning for is that if it does, Nicole and I are the only two people that get to decide what happens with it, because we own that book 100%.
If I could, I'm going to probably add a mic drop or some really loud applause. Well fucking said. I didn't want to blow up, you know, the mic stuff, but man, well said. And I wanted to apologize. I didn't mean to put you on the spot or you know, in hot water. It's just that your tweet was the only perspective I saw from that angle amongst, you know, the many tweets I was seeing about the topic. And I was like, wow, I think he's onto something here and I'd like to learn more about it. So thank you for sharing that. Which leads me to my next question, which is, you know, you guys are very proud, you know, indie comic creators. You guys spoke about the many years that you guys did publishing your own comics. So I've got to ask, how is it working for Dark Horse? We had Matt Lesniewski on a few weeks ago, and he spoke about, you know, his book Static, and he was also in the same position as well. You know, indie publisher, or sorry, he was self-publishing, is a better term. He was self-publishing. He got this opportunity. And you know, he enjoyed Dark Horse because they were, you know, big advocates, you know, basically like cheerleaders for them, you know, lack of better terms. And I was curious what your experience has been like, you know, moving from that self publishing route to now, you know, having, you know, Dark Horse essentially publish your book for you.
Yeah, our experience with Dark Horse has been kind of the best case scenario for what it is, where we had almost complete creative freedom with the book that we wanted to make. Our editor, Connor Knudsen, is absolutely a cheerleader. He's amazing. He cares about the book. He's always like amping us up and talking about how great it is, all this stuff. And he wants the book to be the best it can be. But the other aspect being that we get to own it completely. We've gotten to do almost anything that we wanted with it. And it's been really good. So it's kind of been like doing what we were already doing, just on a larger scale. Now there's the stuff that comes with the package is, you know, you have to wait for editorial, you have to wait for contracts, you have to wait for printing, you have to do design tests, you have to do all these things. You're not completely in control in the same way, and you don't get to have a say in every aspect of the process. But for the step up that we've made and the broader audience that we're getting from putting a book out at a company like Dark Horse, it's really been probably the closest that we could find to being able to do it almost completely ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think it says something pretty interesting about a publisher that is going to publish Hellboy and our book.
Right, yeah.
You know, that's a pretty wide right? spectrum, and that's exciting to me. You know, that's yeah.
We got in on some good timing because Dark Horse is making a push into the book market right now. I don't know how much you pay attention to book sales, but middle grade and YA comics
dominate.
Has grown like 25%, like in the last 25% a year in like the last couple of years, you know? And so Dark Horse is really trying to be like, oh, like maybe we should try this. Maybe we should push into this other part of the industry. And, you know, not that Dark Horse is changing that much of how they're running things necessarily, but that's really where the money is in the industry right now, for better or for worse. I mean, I love weekly comics. I go to the shop, I buy floppies. I love all that. And I will be very sad if that goes away. However, the market is really starting to shift over to the book market and full-length OGNs and that kind of stuff. And we were able to get in at a time when Dark Horse was willing to start telling some stories that aren't, you know, like, just Hellboy or just, you know, whatever they kind of were previously doing, which was already a pretty broad range in terms of comics. But, you know, it was good timing for us that they were willing to take a chance on a story like ours, which may not have been something they were willing to do before, but fits a little better into this book market, which I'm really excited about because it really broadens the range of people who are going to have access to and be interested in comics. You know, in order to get comics up until this point, you kind of have to like go to a shop, and that can be intimidating for a lot of people. And it's so much nicer for people to just be able to walk around a bookstore, see something, be like, oh, I like that. And they're not going out of their way to get it. They're not making a point of doing that. So you might be able to bring in some people who wouldn't have normally picked up a comic because they saw something and thought it looked cool. You know, I think it really broadens the ability to reach people and to tell all kinds of stories.
Well said. And I can't recall the article or the stats specifically, but it was essentially about, you know, I think when people think of like comic book sales and things, you know, it is that traditional mindset of, you know, floppies, the big two, maybe like big three at the most. But what's really dominating the comic book market itself is, like you said, YA. I think a manga is also like super strong, if not outselling comics like left and right. And then also, you know, webtoons, you know, is also on the rise too. So I'm glad to hear that Dark Horse has that foresight and is willing to expand their offerings and things.
And a lot of that credit goes directly to Connor. Hmm. Like he sought us out. He found us at a convention and was like, hey, I really liked Fuck Off Squad. Do you guys have anything that's kind of like this? And we were like, well, yes, we do. And honestly, like he's the one who went to the meetings. Like Dark Horse, you know, every company has their own way they approve projects. And for Dark Horse, there's a series of editorial meetings where they get all the editors together and, you know, they have to pitch their projects to the other editors. And Connor went to all those Dark Horse meetings and was like, this is the thing. this is the thing. This is it. Let's do this. And
yeah, he really fought for the book. Awesome.
Yeah.
You know, because it wouldn't have happened without him. Getting past the editors is only the first step, you know, and we're very lucky that Connor came to us on this one. But once he has a project in mind that he wants to do, then he has to get it approved by everybody else at the company, you know, and he has to convince them just as much as we have to convince him. So having someone within a company who's willing to go to bat for you and your story is really important.
Yeah.
Awesome. And I want to take a shift to maybe something a little more lighthearted, because Nicole, you brought up that you still go to comic shops, you still pick up books, and I'm assuming the same for you as well, Dave. I was curious, what's on your pull list? What are you guys picking up on a weekly basis? Oh, Dave's ready.
We went to the store on Saturday.
Well, you want to give us? Yeah.
Tell you right
which
now.
Shop do you guys go to?
I go to Mega City One, okay, which is on Melrose here in Los Angeles. Nice. But we were up at Nicole's mom's house this past weekend, and so we went to Arsenal Comics and Games, which is a really nice shop. And I bought Planetary X-Men #1, which was pretty cool. I liked that a lot. Janna and the Impossible Monsters.
Chris Samnee and his wife, right? Fantastic. Yep. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yep. Yeah, we both bought that.
yep.
Right, Sharon.
Chris Samnee is one of the best living illustrators. He's amazing.
He's absolutely incredible.
The book is so good.
Ridiculous.
The dude can do superhero. He can do YA. I mean, like, there really isn't anything he can do. And I think Janna just showcases
it. Yeah.
Completely.
Absolutely.
I also picked up my my personal senpai, James Stokoe's Orphan and the Five Beasts.
That is fucking great. Yeah, I grew up on like kung fu flicks, and my dad always had some Shaw Brothers playing in the house at all times.
Yeah.
So when I read the description of that, where James is like, "Yo, this is gonna be like my tribute to Shaw Brothers," I said, "Add me to this. Add this to my pull list right now."
What's your favorite Shaw Brothers movie?
Oh man, probably Deadly Five Venoms. If you give me a second,
that's a solid. That's a classic.
Yeah, I think that's
a classic.
If you give me a sec, I'm going to go over to my... I actually took a bunch of movies from my pops, so I'll take a look at it and give you a better list. Nicole, what's on your pull list?
So I'm currently without shop because I worked at a shop called Quest here in downtown LA, and we closed during the pandemic. Oh, so I lost my shop that I was at. I worked there every Wednesday, and so I would just pick up my books with my there. So I haven't actually... and I was very... it was very indoors during most of the pandemic, so I kind of didn't really pick up much, but we've just started going again. And so we've gone to Melrose a couple of times, and then we went to this shop by my mom's house. And I also picked up Janna, and Firepower, which is also Somni, of course, Somni and Kirkman. And then, I've been reading Layla Starr, which is a boom book
by
Ram V and Felipe Andrade.
None of my crew is reading it. So I come on the show every month it comes out. And I'm like, yo, y'all have no idea. Is that not one of the best looking books with such a unique concept?
Oh,
come on.
God, it is gorgeous. The facility that Felipe Andrade has with his drawings, the way that he exaggerates and pulls form. And it's just so gorgeous. And I'm actually really pleasantly surprised by the storytelling. I haven't read any of Ram V's other stuff. I know
he's doing
the Rhapsody in Blue was the name of the other book.
What was the other one? What was?
Or was it Rhapsody in Blue?
Green and Blue.
Green and Blue. Okay. It was jazz thing. So I was like, that seems right. I know that book got a lot of talk, and I've seen some pages from it, and they look beautiful as well. But I hadn't read anything that he wrote before, and I'm really liking his storytelling. This most recent issue, I don't know if you read it yet. I don't want to spoil
it. It's number three. Yes, I have.
So it's all from the perspective of a cigarette. Mm-hmm.
What?
And
when it dawned on me, I was like,
I know.
Wait a minute. Is he? No, he's not. He's not writing a cigarette's perspective on this whole transaction between Layla and then the prophecy. Like, it was like, come on, man. Yeah, that dude.
And also just the structure of the book is really nice. Where it's like every 8 years or something, she dies, and then you get another look into the snippet of her life in relation to the snippet or in relation to the boy's life, and it's a really well put together book, I think.
For sure.
I'm really enjoying it. And then I got Made in Korea, which is by Jeremy Holt and George Shaw and Adam Woolett, which I have not read yet, but we know Jeremy. They're really nice, and I'm very excited to read this book. And it looks great.
Adam, I don't know if you're listening, but shout outs to my boy Adam Woolett. He was a co-host on this show for years. He took a break to, you know, really focus in on lettering, but man, I'm so happy to see Jeremy Holt and Adam Wallet still cranking out work. Yo, dang, that's awesome.
These letters are nice.
Yeah, no, awesome. Yeah. I'm going to let him know. That's
yeah,
cool.
Really cool.
No, I've got some solid homework and recommendations from you too. You guys are a lot of fun. And you're both of you have a solid taste in comics. So great list. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm not, you know, I shouldn't be surprised at all because you guys wrote a fantastic comic in Everyone is Tulip. And I wanted to go ahead and wrap up this interview by asking, I normally ask for general, you know, advice that you would give aspiring creators, but I feel like that is all this interview has been, you know, hell, just read Everyone is Tulip and you'll probably get even more gems. So I want to kind of hone in on it and ask, you know, for maybe like inside kind of baseball advice in the sense of, Dave, from your perspective, what is some advice for aspiring writers that you would give that you wish you would have gotten, you know, early on in your career that is specific to writers? And same question for you, Nicole, but, you know, from an artist perspective. And it could be technical or maybe just general writing advice.
I think starting small, self-publish, go to conventions. I think that applies across the board. I think also really think hard about if you're going to take a deal that you don't own completely. Like, I'm not even saying don't do it. I'm just saying really fucking think about that shit. Because from a writer's perspective, most writers think like, oh, that's just the idea that I'm giving away to get to the next level. I don't know, man. Get a lawyer.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a hell of a way to live, bro. I don't know, man. And not that I even think that ideas are finite. I think you will have many exciting ideas that people will like. The issue at hand is that you can't always control what becomes a hit and what doesn't. And if you're not precious with your ideas and you don't have the self-respect to be able to defend them in the public court, I don't know, man. Hmm. I don't know. I think everybody has to do what's right for them. And what's right for me is not what's going to be right for somebody else. But I think that there's a good case to be made for betting on yourself and doing it the long and hard way, which will suck, but will at least give you the self-gratification of being able to say, I did it my way. Although now that song is ruined. I love that song. And fucking Trump used that song when he left office. You fucking piece of shit. Now I can't even enjoy my...
He's ruined a few of songs that I messed with prior. So I know the feeling.
Man. All right. Well, just let it be known that was not a passive endorsement of some dog whistle or some shit.
Nicole, what about you? Do you got anything to add?
I mean, I think Dave and I have a lot of overlap because we have a lot of similar ideas about, you know, ownership and we make stuff together. So there is a lot of, you know, the do the conventions, the start small, all those things are kind of truism in our general spiels when we talk about comics. But the other thing I would say and add to that is don't wait until someone tells you that you can make the thing. Just go out and make it, because I know there's a lot of people, I think particularly writers, because they feel like they can't do it themselves. And then sometimes with artists, you know, for me, when I was in middle school, I loved comics, but I never sat down and made a comic because I was waiting for a writer. I wanted someone to be like, here's the story. And, you know, it's great if you can find a partner. In fact, that's my other thing. If you can find a partner, do it, because it's the best. It helps so much. But don't ever wait for a publisher to give you the okay before making the thing that you want to make. Don't wait for someone else to tell you, you have been anointed. Now you can do the thing. Because if you never make anything and never put it out there, how is anyone going to know that you can do it? How is anyone going to know that you're good? how are you going to learn to be good? You have to learn by doing the thing. And, you know, when Dave asked me, you know, do you want to make a comic? And I was like, that's not really what I do. I could have sat there and done a bunch of research and planned out my big epic story and made the best comic I could ever want to make. But it probably wouldn't have ended up being good, or I would have never done it, or I would have never finished it, because that idea and that effort is too big. So you have to kind of just start small, make some stuff, put it out there, learn on the job. Because if I had waited to make this story with Dave because I didn't think I was good enough yet, or I didn't know how to do a comic, maybe I would have never made comics at all, you know? And it really is just about doing the thing. Also, put your real name and a real website with a real email on it in your Twitter bio. It's a very practical thing, because, you know, this is something I hear from editors regularly, but also Dave and I were searching for colorists when we were trying to find someone to color this book. And we found Ellie actually through, we did a talk at a school and we met her in person, but I went through so many people's profiles trying to find a colorist who I thought fit the book. And, you know, there's all these really wonderful people in there who have aliases or just no information about who they are or no sequentials or whatever. And you really need to make yourself contactable and findable if you ever want to get a job.
Yeah, you can't just ride off the you know, Color Lord 5000, you know, with no contact.
There's some amazing people that I might have hired if they had wanted to do the job, but I don't even know what their name is, because it's just like from Avatar and a you know, random handle of,
yeah, we were
25.
We were this close to hiring Monster 6969 Monster.
Damn it, Monster 6969 Monster. You blew your shot.
You blew your shot,
you
bro.
You thought your name was too cool to have an email. No, that is some solid advice. Dave, Nicole, this has been a conversation worth having, and I can't stress that enough. Thank you both so much for sharing your time with me and the Shortbox Nation to chat about your craft, your careers, as well as everyone as Tulip. Best of luck in the coming days, because I can only imagine that the promo and you know, hopping on interviews and whatnot is only going to ramp up for you too. But do you want to share anything with the listeners before we sign off? Maybe any parting words? Let them know where to follow or reach you.
Everyone is Tulip comes out in comic book stores June 30th, in bookstores July 14th, or you can read it online right now, being serialized 3 pages a week at everyoneistulip.com. We're doing that to just try and get the word out about the book.
Yeah.
So literally you can read like 60 pages of it for fucking free.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hang out with me on the internet, you can do so on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at xDaveBakerX. Or if you want to listen to my podcast called Deep Cuts, where my co-host Andrew Price and I pick an obscure topic and then walk the listeners through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so that they can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at their next forced social function.
Ooh, that outro that you just said comes from many years of having to say that. I reckon from one podcaster to one another, I'm like, oh, he said that many a times. That is ingrained in his brain.
Yes.
But I will say,
yes.
Folks, as you guys know, I normally bleep out any other podcast names on the short box. But I joke, of course.
I'm sorry.
It's a running joke. But I will say, check out Deep Cut Podcast. I have in my queue right now, Dave, your Metal Gear Solid, or what was it? How Metal Gear Solid Pushed Out Hideo Kojima.
I'm
super excited to listen to that. So
that episode is like 4 hours long.
Just like a normal video, a Metal Gear Solid game. Okay.
It's like a normal. Also, I will say, you know, our show is a little unconventional in that it is a deep dive explainer podcast. And usually I don't tell people this because it's more fun for them to just figure it out. But since you're going into the Hideo Kojima one, I'm going to let you know. Our show is a deep dive explainer podcast where my co-host Andrew Price and I talk about stuff. But there's also another level to it where periodically the podcast will stop and Andrew and I go on adventures with our Muppet roommate. And it's this kind of like grand epic space opera story sometimes. So it's basically like half explainer podcast, half radio serial from the 1940s.
Oh, I am so on board for this. What? a Muppet show in the middle of my podcast? Come on.
Basically, hey. And the episode, that Hideo Kojima episode, was our mid-season two finale. So it is, there's a song in it. There's recurring villains that pop up. There's new characters. And then there's also a ton of Hideo Kojima stuff. Ooh. So don't worry. It's there. But I'm just prepping you that if you're 20 minutes in and it's me and Andrew and a red furry Muppet and a robot on a spaceship, and you're like, what the fuck is this? I thought this was going to be a Hideo Kojima explainer. You'll get there.
I appreciate it. And I don't know if I'd expect anything else from a LA podcaster. So I appreciate that and I respect it. Nicole, any parting words? Where can people find you?
Well, I don't have anything as exciting as me and a Muppet going on space adventures, but you can find my work at NicoleGoo.com. My Twitter is at NicoleGoo and my Instagram is at NGoo, last name spelled G-O-U-X. I mostly post art and now I'm posting videos of me learning to skate. So if you want to watch me embarrass myself, a good place to go.
That might be just as entertaining, if not maybe a little more than this Muppet show then.
I hope so.
All right, well, I appreciate both of you so much. Best of luck and everything going forward, and please don't be a stranger to the Short Box, man. We'd love to have you guys back on soon. Right?
Fuck yeah. Okay, let's do good. It
oh yeah. All right, Dave, Nicole, be well, take care, thank you guys so much. Right?
Bye.
Well, there you have it, Short Box Nation. Let's give it up one more time for our guest, and please, man, do yourself a favor. Visit your local comic shops or your favorite bookstore and pick up a copy of Everyone is Tulip. And as I love to say, you know the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Tell us what you thought about this episode. Feel free to reach out to us on social media or send a letter to our inbox at theshortboxjacks@gmail.com. And please make sure you're subscribed to the show on your favorite podcast app, because next week, the OG Shortbox crew will be hosting the show. That's right. Drew and Walt will be joining me next week. We'll be talking about X-Men that drops next Wednesday. But if that's too long for you to wait, consider joining our Patreon community for some new bonus episodes we're about to drop. We just recorded another episode of our spinoff podcast series, Pilot's License, and it's all about the Gargoyles animated series. I'll have a link to our Patreon community in the show notes for those of you interested. And last but not least, there is still time to enter in our giveaway for a bag of the new Threat Supply and Bold Bean Coffee Collabo. To enter, all you got to do is champion your favorite new comic or give us a recommendation to try out. It could be a TV, a movie, a video game, a book, whatever it may be. Send in your submission by writing a short email to theshortboxjacks@gmail.com or leave a short voicemail at speakpipe.com/theshortbox. Send in your submission by the end of the month and we'll pick one winner on our Black Widow episode dropping July 7th. This contest is open to U.S. residents only, but you know what? We'll cover shipping and handling if you live outside Jacksonville. So get those submissions in, all right? In the meantime, look, take care of yourselves, have a great week, and please continue to make mine and yours Short Box. Peace.